Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with Stephen Hope. Stephen is one of the most favorite performers, actor, singer, dancer, stage manager, choreographer at Florida Studio Theater in Sarasota, Florida. I interviewed Stephen for the first time several years ago, and I'm going to play part of that interview today and follow it with Stephen talking about the current work he's doing at Florida Studio Theater, that is performing in their production of Hairspray. Stephen's story is interesting and compelling, and he himself is funny, charming, and delightful. So hang on, here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down survive, finding wisdoms otherwise. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not some version of yourself. Not the person you think other people want you to be. Not the one you think you should be. Not the one they told you to be. Not the one everybody else is, but the person you really are. That may be more difficult than it seems. As a psychotherapist, I see over and over and over again people who are pretending, although they're not even aware, that the person they demonstrate isn't really the whole person they are. So how would you know if you were not really demonstrating the whole of you? How would you recognize if you were hiding some important piece of you that somehow got left behind in your childhood? Well, one of the ways you can know that is if you think there's a quality, a behavior, a skill, a way of being that you always wanted to try. And when you see someone else sculpting a vase, when you see someone else singing on stage, when you see someone else, maybe even someone you know, standing up for themselves and not giving away their power, when you see any other kind of behavior or activity or skill and you feel envy, you think, oh, I wish I could do that. Or maybe even you did do some of that in your childhood. Maybe there are stories about you and how you, you know, stood up to your mommy when she tried to punish you and what you got for it. Or when you drew on the wall with your crayons and got punished for it. Or, and you know, there are as many stories as there are people to tell them. When you recognize this yearning, sometimes what it means is that you actually have that, but have had a really good reason for denying it, hiding it, and pretending that it isn't so. So, in my show, I play interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. We make it so difficult for people to give a life to an art in this culture. And so those who choose to do it because it is who they really are. Today's interview is with Stephen Hope, who you will hear in everything Stephen says. That he is someone who is deeply connected to who he really is and has spent his life pursuing that, being that, challenging that, coming back to it. And I'm not going to say very much more about that because Stephen says it so much better. So here now, Stephen Hope. So I am here with Stephen Hope, and I only have really one question. How did it start for you, this love affair with the theater?
How did it start? It's really hard for me to pinpoint that exact moment. I come from a large, extended southern family, and everybody played an instrument, and we always sang, and I came from a family that had everything from the Beatles to Mahalia Jackson, mm-hmm. to Beethoven and Barbara Streisand. All of these things were being played at all times. Country Western is part of my heritage. Mm-hmm. So performing there's so many varying degrees of performance. There's performing when you're performing with your family, mm-hmm. when you're sitting around the piano and singing. And then there is performing when you're performing for a larger group of people, mostly strangers. That moment probably happened for me in junior high school. I traveled a lot as a kid. My father got his degree at the University of Florida. So he got his undergrad work was done at Mercer University in Macon. And then graduate work in Gainesville. And then postdoctoral work in St. Louis.
Oh, my God.
And then his first position was with the Lion's Eye Institute in Louisville, which is where I did my sophomore through senior year of high school.
So while this was going on, they were having children?
I'm it.
Oh, they were having child.
I was more than enough. I'm quite the handful.
Oh, so... When you said you had all this extended family, I thought that meant siblings, but it doesn't.
No, I came like on the tail end of my mother's siblings. So I was never really just the nephew. I was kind of like the littlest brother.
Brother, yeah.
So it was awful hard to get.
You're the baby in an extended family and the only child in your parents' family.
In my parents' family.
Oh, nothing like being the little prince.
No. Oh, no.
Oh, no. Oh, no, little prince.
Like I said, I was at the tail end of my mother's siblings.
I see.
So it was, I was very fortunate growing up with spending as much time with my grandparents as I did. And my mother's parents were both alive. My grandmother is still alive. My father's mother was alive. They were just all extraordinary. And my aunts and uncles, who I adore. And I was the first grandchild. and the first nephew. So, yeah, I was doted on when I was a baby, but after that, you couldn't get into trouble. There were just way too many eyes on
you. I see. So it was kind of a mixed blessing. I mean, on the one hand, you were a favorite child.
Yeah. For a few years, yes.
Four?
Eight? Eight, maybe.
Eight? That's all it takes.
And then the next, and then I did have a...
Oh, then someone else had a baby?
Well, I had a cousin who we were separated from because of divorce for years. And then the next grandchild was a daughter.
Aye. I see.
So
how much younger than you is she?
Eight, 9 years, I think.
Okay, but you had 8 years.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you do have this extended,
yeah.
this very loving, very theatrical family.
My grandfather was a minister, so yes, there's theater involved in the ministry. Standing up in front of a group of people.
Trying to
sway
them.
Four times a week.
Hello, trying to...
Or comfort them, or just...
Impact.
Impact is a good way of putting that.
Okay, so did you study, or you just picked it up?
I did take piano when I was in junior high, and I was a piano secondary in college. I was sick a lot as a kid, and so my father bought me... what is called a tenor guitar. It's not to be confused with a baritone ukulele. It's a guitar with four strings because my hands were too small to to play all six strings. So that's how I started learning to play the guitar. Not through lessons, but just through playing with the family and by myself. Piano, all of my mother's siblings play the piano. So I had a lot of lessons in that way growing up. I took real lessons in junior high school.
So you learned theory?
I was not very good at it, but I tried to learn theory.
I remember it myself.
It was like way too mathematical for me.
Okay, so take me to that moment in junior high.
You know, I think traveling around so much, being in so thrown into new situations so often, there was something about being able to get up on a stage, and this was for a production of The Wizard of Oz, and I played the Cowardly Lion. There was something about the laughter that I heard that because of what I was doing that was so enjoyable, mm-hmm. knowing that at that moment I was making people laugh.
Yeah.
And I also think that because we were all laughing at the same thing, we were all part of the same experience. So we were not separate at that moment. We weren't unknowns to each other. We were experiencing that moment together, which made us one.
Yeah, it's a very powerful experience.
It is.
And it's interesting because on the one hand, we have this boy who is immersed in a group, right? Part of an extended group to which he clearly belongs. And on the other hand, we have this boy who's a singleton in his family, mm-hmm. and is traveling around all over the place, so is not really, is that correct?
That's exactly right.
Right.
Exactly right.
Right. So the stage experience gave you a little bit of the, I am a part of something larger than myself, or that's not right?
I think what it did was it for that moment, for those moments, it created the family.
Yes, yes,
yes. It created the unit.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think it also gave me a sense of, I'm going to say power. I don't think power is the right, but it was the ability to impact a group of people.
Oh, yeah.
That is just, you know it's right. You feel this moment that it's right, which again is what theater is all about. It's about that moment, that individual moment that will never happen again, has never happened before, will never happen again. And that's why that impact that you have with that group of people is because you know you have shared a unique experience. I don't think I knew that. That's not how I put it.
I'm quite sure that's right. But I think you're right. I also think that it's an interesting combination of things. It's a, I am a part of this, and yet I am an individual who's having an impact. It's the it's both of them at the same time. Pretty heady stuff, right? Pretty seductive. Also, there's, I think, from the way you're describing, and I don't know that everyone feels this, that there is a sense of intimacy that's pretty powerful.
Oh, the sense of the intimacy is extremely powerful. I had an acting teacher who at one point said, our job is to show humanity on stage because so many out there are unable to feel it in their day-to-day life. I believe that because I grew up with so much love in my family, it was very easy for me to be emotionally open in that way. And yet, because I was a loner, because I was an only child, and you know, you're removing the kid from the family, the big family unit, and going halfway across the country, that being on stage gave me the outlet, as you said before, to kind of reconnect with
right.
a unit. Now, there's the other part about that we're talking about real heady stuff, but this, the fact of the matter is I got to be on stage at that point in a lion costume and play. I was playing. How bad can that be?
Right.
It was play.
Okay, so we have you as a lion. Right.
As a lion, right.
And you have this experience, and it stands out, obviously, because you remember it. And so, what made you audition? Because up until now, singing, playing, music, I didn't hear acting. So what made you, this is a straight play.
I really don't know.
Huh?
Except I was in a junior high school, and I was already connected with the arts group of the high school, of the junior high. And everybody was doing that.
Yeah, so you just did. Right, okay.
I went along with the crowd.
Exactly, and you were sort of a part of a group, weren't you? And you did what the group did, which is what your experience had been, right? Were you surprised to be cast?
I wasn't originally cast as the lion.
Ooh.
I was originally cast as, I think, the mayor of Munchkin City or something like that.
Yes.
And my best friend, his name was Kermit Saunders, was cast as the lion. And he grabbed me and took me to the teacher. And he said, I don't think I should be playing. I think he should be playing that.
Did he say why?
I don't remember.
Do you remember being surprised or curious or delighted or mad?
I was delighted.
You were?
Yes, I was delighted. It's funny, I don't dwell a lot on those kinds of memories, that I remember that this is what happened, this is how it happened, and that it was a good experience, that it was a good memory. But as far as the details are concerned, I have a visual of us standing in the open door of the teacher's classroom.
Yeah.
that's kind of
But what that means to me is that was really significant.
It was.
For you to have that image. I mean, my God, thousands and millions and billions of things happen to us and we don't have images of it.
Right.
Right?
You don't have that visual, that mental
That's
picture
right. exactly.
of it.
Exactly. Right. So that must have been very significant.
It was.
Right. And, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, there's another aspect of this that I think it shouldn't be overlooked. So I played this part in a junior high school piece, was successful, and I got a lot of attention.
Mm, yeah, I was going to ask about that. Right.
So I think that also goes back to only child, that attention, getting that.
That feels right.
It feels right.
Yes, it does.
And I knew I must have been doing something right.
Yes. So then do you remember that you thought maybe I could do this or you didn't do that at all?
Not at that point, no.
No, okay. So do you remember where the next moment is?
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. The next moment happens when I am a junior in high school, and this is in Louisville, Kentucky. And we're doing Camelot. And I was cast as King Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a junior, and I'm cast in the lead. This is not done, or was not done in high school. Seniors got the lead. That was the way it worked.
Right.
And there was something about that character that I really connected with as well. I think it was the idealism, the humanity of him trying to make the world a better place for everyone.
He's such a good guy.
Oh, he's a great guy, and he's a believer in the goodness of the human soul, above the even forgiving his wife and his best friend for betraying him.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a wonderful character. My dad doesn't remember this. I remember this. He said, I think he probably came to every single performance, he and my mother. He said, I think this is what you should be doing. He doesn't remember that, but I sure do.
No kidding.
That's a powerful moment, to have that kind of support from your father.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's that powerful, say, with the relationship between a daughter and a mother, but that relation, that acceptance and that support for a son from his dad is pretty significant. I laugh because I don't think he doesn't remember, or he chooses not
to remember.
There's a little too much emotion involved.
Oh, I see. He's a scientist or something.
He's a scientist,
right. And you don't want to go there. I was thinking something else. I was thinking, then you did it, and he's not sure. He wants to take responsibility for that. you did that smile.
No, I was really blessed in that I had the support of my family.
Yeah.
And have had the support of my family.
Well, and that's pretty interesting, because from someone whose life is very different, to be able to see that in you and not do what so many parents do, which is, oh no, you have to be like me, or you have to live the life that I think is right, or whatever that is. Your father didn't do that. Kudos to him.
Kudos to that entire extended family. Now, I know that they may have been sitting there going, thinking, what is he going to do? How is it?
Right.
But they were supportive of it. And that I find to be really interesting. I find that to be very far ahead of their
time. It's extraordinary. Well, and the other thing that's interesting to me about this is that you're the only child. If there are a bunch of them and they lose one to the arts, okay, fine. You know what I mean?
But one starving artist is
enough, right? Okay, but to have all of your hopes and dreams on the one, and to allow that one to take the risk of being in the arts—that's a big deal, because it is a risk. Everybody knows it's a risk.
It was a risk to them. It never seemed to be a risk to me. It seemed to be the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew even then when I was on stage, I knew that this was where I felt at home, where I was comfortable, and living that heightened reality for those 2 hours a night, or with Camelot, 2.5. and also, my mother has always been extremely supportive as well, in a very different way. And my mom's background is in literature and history. On one hand, I had my dad, the scientist, and I had my mother, who was a teacher of history and literature, and then went into library sciences.
Uh-huh.
So I had a really, there was a nice balance there.
Yeah. And probably, everybody played music.
And everybody sang and played music, yeah. It was interesting. And I'm a child of the 60s. College campuses of the 60s.
Oh, my God, right.
You know, that's a pretty mind-blowing experience. and I think there's, because of that, there was a lot of freedom given to me to explore.
Okay, so we have you in junior and high school, and essentially the die is cast.
Yeah, I'm afraid so, yes.
Yes. So now it's time to think about colleges, and what did you do?
Since my parents were on the faculty of the University of Louisville, I went to the University of Louisville School of Music as a voice major. The faculty did not want me to be a voice major. They thought I was better suited for education.
On what did they base that?
It was a classical music school, and I do not have a classical voice.
And so, whoa, how odd. So they thought you should teach?
They thought I should teach.
God.
Well, that's, again, we're talking about a period of time where the powers that be felt that it was important to guide you into where you were best
suited. Well, what's so interesting to me is that not
this
your parents...
This is a
parents,
school.
Right? The school? That's so odd.
It is very strange.
Yes. So did you persevere, or they got
you? Well, what happened was I got wind of a school in Cincinnati called the College Conservatory of Music, better known as CCM. Great, great people have come out of CCM, and I was in a wonderful class. I, on my own, with a friend from college who drove me up, I did out all the admission papers and everything on my own. He drove me up there. My parents knew, drove me up there to audition. I did a terrible audition, singing Soliloquy from Carousel, and did singing to My Little Girl very pompously. And I remember the professors going, whoa, 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 whoa. But what they did was they then directed me, and I was able to make this switch, this complete opposite switch.
So they could see that you could.
They saw that I...
You had it.
I had, was open, yeah, at least to being able to explore different things. I was accepted. And then went to the University of Cincinnati for 2 years before I quit.
Ooh.
I don't know where this, how, I just knew that this was what I was supposed to be doing. This was the path I was supposed to be taking. There was never any question about it. So I am in... at the University of Cincinnati with an incredibly talented group of people studying musical theater in a cocoon, because the conservatory is its own building, opera, dance, stagecraft, and musical theater all together, piano, all of the arts were all in this one building. I am immersed in, I started, really started dancing at that point, with it, like in class, learning about stagecraft and design and what happens, what really happens backstage, focused on performance of musical theater, which is odd because that was not really my focus from the outset, was legit theater, straight theater, which is where my heart is strongest. I think this came from that again, period of time where we are going to tear you down so that we can build you up from scratch. So I never seemed to be able to do it right in school. And yet, I was working also a lot outside of school. Well, in the real world, so to speak, people were grabbing to have me come and work with them. After my junior year, I woke up one morning and said, I'm going to move to New York. And I'd never been to New York. Cincinnati was the biggest city I had ever been in. I'm going to move to New York. And so at the end of that summer, I up and moved to New York. Moved in with some friends.
Okay, so you moved to New York. Apparently you survived.
I did survive. That first year was rough, but I did survive. I worked at Macy's. And I worked for Citibank. Got a call from the choreographer that I had worked at Kings Island the year before that. She said, please come help me restage the show in Richmond, and we'll put you in Richmond until for preseason weekends, and then we'll move you down to Charlotte, and you'll do the summer in Charlotte. So I did that. I came back to New York, immediately started auditioning again, and got my Equity card, playing Robin, as in Robin the Boy Wonder, as in Batman and Robin, in a... an arena show called Bugs Bunny in Space.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Oh goodness.
And so I did that. I was on the road with that. I started to develop shin splints. And I left the tour, went back to New York. Another friend from the tour, who had also left, called me up and said, another friend of ours who was on the tour had injured himself in an audition, and they needed somebody else for this show they were doing at the York Theater. Now, I don't really know what the York Theater is at this point, nor did I really know the importance of the piece that we were doing, but it was the first New York revival of Stephen Sondheim's Anyone Can Whistle.
Oh, my.
And I called the director, went in and auditioned, and Anne was cast in the show.
Wow.
So it's my first New York show. I'm working with a very well-known off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway theater company called the York Theater Company. Mm-hmm. I have the opportunity to work with up-and-coming directors, scenic designers, music directors, Stephen Sondheim, and Arthur Lawrence.
Oh my God, really? Right. It's...
It is, so when I look back on it now, I think, no, I followed the path that I was supposed to follow. Now, just to furthermore this whole thing, so I do that. Then the next thing that happened is while I'm there, I audition. I spend the summer working at Radio City Music Hall in New York City. From there, I am called by someone that I work with there to come and replace somebody in a new piece, a new musical version of Great Expectations. I go audition in somebody's apartment. I get this part. I go in and I do that. They call me. And would you come on in and sing for this guy? I go in and I sing for him. I get 3 months on the cruise ship. The company that I worked with before wants me to come and choreograph for them for the summer. I go there. I go back to New York. I run into a friend. I'm going to one audition. He says, come stand in line with me. We used to do that in those days. Come stand in line. Guys, just stand in line with me. And since I'm in line, I might as well go on and stand in line. And I'm going to go on and sing. I've got my music and everything. And I walk in and I sing for a little off-Broadway show called Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Oh, my God.
And am cast. Mm-hmm. My God bless my friend. He's not. But I am. So now within 3 years of being in New York, I worked with Stephen Sondheim, Arthur Lawrence, Tim Rice, and Andrew Lloyd Webber.
So I guess the message there is that you followed your bliss and
I followed
you
my
were
bliss
right.
And I was right.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. And I was young enough and I think naive enough to know that this is what I'm feeling, this is what I should do. Do it.
Right.
No questions about it. Right. Just do it.
Right. It's perfect. It's perfect.
And it's an amazing experience. It took me a long time to be able to place all of the
see
that
it.
Timeline
to,
and
yeah,
see it.
Right, to get the perspective of what it actually was. Right.
I'm not as naive as I was then. Yeah. But I have worked with, other than a period of time that I took away just to try other things. I was in my late 20s. And I just felt like I had never done anything else. So I did go and I taught myself to touch type. And I worked briefly for lawyers.
Hmm.
Which was a really interesting experience. I was like a floater, a temp. I would come in and I would like do night work. Because I found that the skills that I had that had made me successful within the theater weren't limited to the theater. Personality, common sense, creativity works in every field. But if your heart's not there, then yes, you can do this. But are you happy? This was a wonderful period of time of just trying to figure out what's going to make me happy.
Right.
Life is short. I started to realize that happiness was the most important thing. And you could be unhappy with a lot of money coming in, or you could be happy, poor. Now, I don't mean poor. The money that we have coming in is what we're going to live on.
Right.
And I was exhausted working at law firms. Worked Monday through Friday, and all I cared about was that weekend. I wanted the weekend. I didn't stop working in the theater. I stopped pursuing work in the theater. The difference is that people pursued me. So while I was doing this, I was still off directing a show or choreographing a show.
Well, no wonder you were exhausted.
That's true. Well, I would leave.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
At one point, I was actually doing an off-Broadway show at the same time I was working mm-hmm. at the law firm. That was exhausting. But I also worked with a group of people. They had a theatrical department, so they kind of understood the field. And I could go away for 3 months and work.
Right.
And come back. And that, it was a temp position. And mm-hmm. come back, and the temp
right.
position was available.
Still there, right.
And then, say, in my 30th. Mm-hmm. started letting all of these other opportunities, and going out and pursuing the opportunities again. Mm-hmm. During that period of time, I had also grown into a very different type as far as an actor is concerned. I was no longer the young character guy.
So
I wasn't the older character guy, but I've never been a leading man. That's not my type. Mm-hmm. But the parts were changing. They were very different. And musical theater was changing. Theater.
Yes, definitely.
And we're talking about the advent of things like Les Miserables and mm-hmm. Phantom of the Opera. And, I came in at the tail end with the season that Joseph moved to Broadway was the season of Dreamgirls mm-hmm. and Nine.
Right.
And Pump Boys and Dinettes. And Joseph was, and we were, all of these shows are up for Best Musical. Cats came in the next season, and then Phantom of the Opera, and then Miss Saigon, and... Mm-hmm. And the invasion, the musical, the
right.
British invasion, which was a great experience for Broadway. Big cast.
Right.
They kept a lot of people employed.
Working. Right.
But a very different style of theater. Now, also remember that legit theater is not really the right term. Straight plays. Angels in America.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So now we have, we have Tony Kushner and Richard Greenberg is writing, and a very different style. Tom Stoppard is really coming into
right.
a major rediscovery in
right.
many ways. David Mamet.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a different style of theater there.
Right.
Big change. At the same time, AIDS. So my journey back into full-time theater was hindered by the physical type that I was, the vocal type that I was, what I was interested in doing, and that the people who knew me from
were
4 years before
right.
were now dead.
Oh, God, right.
So it was reintroducing myself to a whole new group of people.
My goodness, what a challenge.
It is, it's a challenge when I look back at it now.
Yeah,
I
right.
mean, then it was just like, this is what you do. You just put one foot in front of the other.
Because this is what I need to do.
This is
because
what
I am
driven to do.
This is what I am
where my heart
driven
is.
To do.
And that ultimately led me back to, I did several really wonderful off-Broadway pieces. And it led me eventually back to the Scarlet Pimpernel on Broadway, which was another interesting experience.
Frank
Wildhorn, yeah. I adore him.
Yeah.
He's a great guy. What happened was I walked in, and it's this is another wonderful kind of experience that I finally am putting this all together. The casting director, who ended up working with Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat some 20 years before, and I was the dance captain on the Broadway production, so we knew each other very well, he and I became reacquainted. He was casting Scarlet Pimpernel. And so they called me in. And I came in, and I knew right away, I knew that I had given one heck of an audition. I just knew it. I knew that it was there. But what I knew was strongest for me was not the vocal part, but was the acting. And I was going in to be what they call a vacation swing, which means after 6 months, people can start going on vacations, and people were going to start going on vacations, and you were there learning that track specifically so that if anything should happen and the other swings, the regular swings, can't cover it, you will go on. Well, I'm not even completely rehearsed, and I go on. I'm told that I'm going to have to go on. Now, this character that I'm going on for, he was, let's say he was significantly older than I was, bigger than I was. He was like a big gold English bulldog, and I'm out there like Noel Coward.
Right, exactly.
What ended up happening was they kept me.
Wow.
And we had one swing who covered the older characters, half of the men. One swing who covered the younger characters. And me who covered all of them.
Wow.
So I covered, in version one, 20 different tracks.
Oh, my goodness.
And in version two, 21.
My goodness.
Again, working with some extraordinary performers. Mm-hmm. It was the tour of that, that I ended up back in Cincinnati for 2 weeks, that I was able to put all of this together and go, wow, this is the path you should have always been on. The one I took was it was like I went into the water and I went with the flow.
Yes.
Doesn't mean that everything works out beautifully. When you're on the right path, the opportunities present themselves. You do not have to go searching for them. They're there. So they become choices. When you are fighting that path, you're out there trying to find those opportunities.
Right.
You're actively searching for them. But the right path, they present themselves.
You know what?
What?
I want to stop there.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
This
was really...
I can talk. I'm from the South.
Yes, you can.
Yeah, sure.
So, as I said in the beginning of the show, you can hear when you listen to Stephen that this is a man who has a direct line to who he is, has always had it, knows when he is being who he really is and when he isn't, and finds his way back. Never mind that it's a challenge, never mind that it may not be easy. Stephen always knows what is true north for him, and he always heads in that direction. And as he said, the world then provided opportunities for him to be what he is so naturally. So having listened to Stephen's story, now I'm going to play Stephen telling us about the current production at Florida Studio Theater in which he is performing, and that is a production of the musical Hairspray. So here's Stephen talking about Hairspray.
So I am here with Stephen Hope yet again in Studio A in Florida Studio Theater. And Stephen told me that he is now in his 30-something show.
I've lost track.
Yeah, right, at Florida Studio Theater. And this is one of the nice things about FST, is that when they find somebody that they love and whose work they appreciate, they just keep hiring them, and it's great. It's great. Okay, so you want to tell us about Hairspray?
Yes, I will tell you about Hairspray. Let me also clarify that that's 30-some-odd shows, and that includes everything from choreographing to performing to stage managing.
Yes.
It covers a large range of things.
Another good reason to continue to hire Stephen Hope, because he can do everything. Right.
So, Hairspray.
Yeah.
All right, I'll start off just with a brief history. Now, Hairspray was originally a film by John Waters. It starred Divine, and Ricky Lake made her debut in this. I think it actually made her a star. It also included the likes of Jerry Stiller, Debbie Harry, who most people know as Blondie, and Sonny Bono.
Really?
Yes. They were the adult leads. I know, then I realized that the film was a cult hit. You look at it today and you kind of go, oh, that's not so shocking. That's not. But in its day, it was a cult hit. The musical opened in, I believe it was 2002, and took home 8 Tony Awards. And that included musical, book of a musical, score, actor, actress, and supporting actor, I believe director as well, and it may have also included choreographer. I have not met anyone who saw the show. They just loved it. I have not seen it. I did not see it in New York. I've only seen the film. So I came to it completely fresh. And I was struck immediately about this inclusive quality that it has to it. It has such heart, and it has such a message of inclusion. And anyone can identify with this show, because at some point we have all been relegated to the outskirts of a group or society. We all can understand what it's like to be, looked down upon for race or weight or your sex or the color of your skin, anything like that. So I think anyone can understand.
So it's a play that highlights the difficulty of being left out or feeling left out.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it's so much fun.
It is a great... Now, not only is it a lot of fun, we'll get to the fun part, because
okay.
I'm... Every day I go to rehearsal, it's like going to a party.
Mm-hmm.
It also takes place in 1962 in Baltimore, Maryland. So we have this great historical view of America at that time. Kennedy, we have Camelot, you know, we're in Camelot era. And we're in 62, so we're starting a true push towards civil rights mm-hmm. and integration. And that, I would say, is kind of the point that the show revolves around, although in civil rights and the integration of, in this particular case, the Corny Collins show, which is, I see as like a cross between the Mouseketeers, the Mickey Mouse Club, and American Bandstand.
Right.
Based on a real show in Baltimore, Maryland, called the Buddy Dean Show. So they would have guests like Annette Funicello and, popular singers of the
right,
day.
Right.
And the first bringing in Tracy Turnblad, who is the lead of our show, one of the leads of the show, who is a young girl of plus size.
Yes, yes.
And because she's a plus size girl, and because she loves to be modern and she teases her hair big, she gets into all sorts of trouble simply because we would have viewed her as a rebel.
Right.
She gets tossed into detention and becomes friends with the African Americans, who are also, of course, getting tossed into detention all the time. She is the instigator of the integration of the Corny Collins show, which is there's problems with the producer and the sponsor, but Corny Collins is also the one who's saying, no, this is the way life is, right? We want to show the kids, as the same kids on the show that are watching the show. Now at the same time we have her mother, who is actually too big to shop at Lane Bryant. And I mean big in all ways. She's tall and she's plus. And it's there's a story there of her coming out of her
shell
of her accepting herself as she is. We also have Tracy's father, who is a wonderful, wonderful, good-hearted soul who loves them no matter what. Doesn't make any difference. He sees beneath all of that. It's a really interesting thing. There's so much going on, and yet you're not pounded in the face by it. We're watching history happen in front of our eyes.
Exactly.
Yes, there's a protest on,
right.
There's a bit of a protest, and they do get arrested.
Yes, right.
But it's treated with such a light touch
yes.
and such heart.
And the whole time they're singing and dancing.
Speaking of which,
yes.
The singing and the dancing, we have... Yesterday, I was standing outside the door listening to one of the songs sung by Motormouth called Big Blonde and Beautiful. It sounded like we had an entire gospel choir in the room. Voices in this production are huge and beautiful, and they're all great musicians, and they're all great dancers. Richard Stafford, who is our director and choreographer, has quite a pedigree. He was in the original Cats and went on to become the choreographic supervisor of that. He was the assistant choreographer on Aspects of Love. He performed also on Broadway in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. So he knows what he's doing, and I don't think that the Florida Studio Theater audiences will have seen anything quite like this.
Wow.
It's a huge, huge show. It's the biggest cast that they've ever had here.
Wow.
There are 21, I believe. And he's got them moving all the time, and they look great doing it, and it's a theatrical Disneyland.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. All right, so come out and see it. It's opening on November 15th, previews before.
I believe we are scheduled to run until January 4th, and of course, as with all shows at Florida Studio Theater, there are the possibilities of a week or two extension.
Yeah. All right. Come out and see it. Come out and see Stephen in his 30-something show.
You're gonna love it.
Thank you, Stephen.
So, listening to Stephen, listening to him talk about his life, his journey, and also this production, you can hear what I hope you always hear in my show, and that is a person speaking from their very self, a person who is not pretending or dissembling, but simply being. It is my hope, as always, that you are inspired by that. Curious to ask yourself, is this how I feel about my life? Do I feel that every day when I get up to do whatever it is I'm going to do, I'm going to a party? So again, I'm hoping that you're asking yourself that question as you listen to Stephen talk not only about his life, but about this particular piece of work, Hairspray. And speaking about Hairspray, we're going to go out on the song that Stephen mentioned, Big, Blonde, and Beautiful. So, as always, I hope that you got something from this show that you can use. Something that inspired you, or just tickled you, or gave you some information you didn't have before. Something that will bring you back, because I will be here again next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be, too.
Once upon a time, girl, I was just like you. Let my extra large largesse shine through. Hair was brown and nappy, never had no fun. I hid under a bushel, which is easier said than done. Then one day my grandma, who was big and stout, she said you gotta love yourself from inside out. And just as soon as I learned how to strut my funky stuff, I found out that the world at large can't get enough. So bring on that pecan pie, pour some sugar on it, sugar, don't be shy. Scoop me up a mess of that chocolate swirl. Don't be stingy, I'm a growing girl.
Tomorrow. bust their tacks.
Quick, call the cops!
We're gonna dance our way to victory!
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go. From the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got to